This is day six of this October 2015 7-day session. And we'll take one more day on the teachings of Korean Zen Master Chinul. And this is from the book, The Collected Works of Chinul, translated by Robert Buswell. I met Buswell at a conference many years ago. I was very impressed with him, very sincere guy, very devout Buddhist, very bright, of course. We're still reading from a chapter called Secrets on Cultivating the Mind. Question, in our case, what is this mind of void and calm, numinous awareness? Chinul, what has just asked me this question is precisely your mind of void and calm, numinous awareness. Why not trace back its radiance rather than search for it outside? For your benefit, I will now point straight to your original mind so that you can awaken to it. Clear your minds and listen to my words. From morning to evening, throughout the 12 periods of the day, during all your actions and activities, whether seeing, hearing, laughing, talking, whether angry or happy, whether doing good or evil, ultimately, who is it that is able to perform all these actions? Speak. If you say that it is the physical body which is acting, then at the moment when one's life comes to an end, even though the body has not yet decayed, how is it that the eyes cannot see, the ears cannot hear, the nose cannot smell, the tongue cannot talk, the body cannot move, the hands cannot grasp, and the feet cannot run? You should know that what is capable of seeing, hearing, moving, and acting has to be your original mind. It is not your physical body. Furthermore, the four elements which make up the physical body are by nature void, empty. They are like images in a mirror or the moon's reflection in water. How can they be clear and constantly aware, always bright and never obscured, and upon activation be able to put into operation sublime functions as numerous as the sands of the Ganges? For this reason it is said, drawing water and carrying firewood are spiritual powers and sublime functions. Doing laundry and mowing the lawn are spiritual powers and sublime functions. This is what we understand when we're doing these things with nothing in the mind. They're wondrous. And then he talks about this original self, true nature. This is the life force of all the Buddhas and patriarchs. Have no further doubts about that. And then he leads us through all the some of the many ways that we conceptualize this true self and picture this true self, all of which have to be erroneous. He says, since it has no form or shape, how can it be large or small? Since it cannot be large or small, how can it have limitations? Since it has no limitations, it cannot have inside or outside. Since there is no inside or outside, there is no far or near. As there is no far or near, there is no here or there. As there is no here or there, there is no coming or going. As there is no coming or going, there is no birth or death. As there is no birth or death, there is no past or present. As there is no past or present, there is no delusion or awakening. As there is no delusion or awakening, there is no ordinary person or sage. As there is no ordinary person or sage, there is no purity or impurity. Since there is no impurity or purity, there is no right or wrong. Since there is no right or wrong, names and words do not apply to it. Since none of these concepts apply, all sense bases and sense objects, all deluded thoughts, even forms and shapes and names and words are all inapplicable. How, then, can it be anything but originally void and calm and originally no thing? It's so hard not to, at least at times, picture this self-nature. It's hard not to picture Mu, for example. I remember catching myself all the time seeing Mu as having some kind of a shape to it. It can't be it. That can't be the essence of Mu. If it has any shape, no matter how vague, then it has lines, it has design to it, it has borders, which means it has limitations. It's limited, and it's not. Our true nature is illimitable. There's nothing outside our true nature. But it's so natural as human beings that we want to give it some form in our mind, or not even that we want to, it just happens that way. But you can be sure that whatever you're picturing as your true nature, Mu, can't be it. There's a verse in the Mumonkan, you describe it in vain, you picture it to no avail. Even again, as I said earlier in Sesshin, even to give it these names, Buddha nature, original mind, essential nature, and so forth, these all are misleading because they give it some kind of definition, suggesting that there's an it there. There's no such thing. But how difficult it is to not give form to what is essentially formless. He continues, at that point where all dharmas are empty, the numinous awareness is not obscured. It is not the same as insentience, for its nature is spiritually deft. This is your pure mind essence of void and calm numinous awareness. This pure, void, and calm mind is that mind of outstanding purity and brilliance of all the Buddhas of the three time periods. It is that enlightened nature which is the original source of all sentient beings. One who awakens to it and safeguards that awakening will then abide in the unitary, unmoving liberation. Although there is a distinction between delusion and awakening, in their basic source, they are one. And as there is neither more of this void and calm mind in the sage, nor less of it in the ordinary person, it is also said, in the wisdom of the sage it is no brighter, hidden in the mind of the ordinary person it is no darker. Since there is neither more of it in the sage nor less of it in the ordinary person, how are the Buddhas and patriarchs any different from others? The only thing that makes them different is that they can protect their minds and thoughts, nothing more. They can protect their minds and thoughts by not dwelling in thoughts, by dwelling in no mind to one degree or another, trying to dwell in no mind, not clinging to anything. Skipping some pages here. Some people do not realize that the nature of good and evil is void. They sit rigidly without moving and, like a rock crushing grass, repress both body and mind. To regard this as cultivation of the mind is a great delusion. If they could see that killing, stealing, sexual misconduct and lying all arise from the self nature, then their arising would be the same as their non-arising. I think of the line in the Hakuin chant, our thought now being no thought. This paradoxical language is very difficult to, well, it's impossible to really grasp it, truly grasp it, without the experience of it. But it's the very essence of the Dharma. They could see that their misconduct all arise, all the forms of misconduct all arise from the self nature, then the arising of these misconduct would be the same as their non-arising. At their source, they are calm. Why must they be cut off? And then he quotes a previous master, do not fear the arising of thoughts. Only be concerned that your awareness of them not be tardy. This is an extremely important point. Maybe a particularly crucial one in this last day of Sesshin. Do not fear the arising of thoughts. They will arise. He said, only be concerned that your awareness of them not be tardy. They will arise. How quickly can we notice that the mind has strayed into thoughts? And once having noticed, how quickly can we bring the mind back? And then he says, it is also said, if we are aware of a thought at the moment it arises, then through that awareness, it will vanish. Goes right to the heart of our work. Let me repeat it. If we are aware of a thought at the moment it arises, then through that awareness, it will vanish. So it's all about awareness. This mind of awareness. This is everything. This mind of awareness, our innate awareness, has been called our Buddha nature. We couldn't lose it, this capacity to be aware of things as they change. Skipping a few pages here, but even though you are not yet able to accept this teaching, if it passes through your ears just once and you feel affinity with it for even a moment, the merit will be incalculable. As it says in Secrets on Mind Only, hearing the Dharma but not believing is still cause for the fruition of the seed of Buddhahood. Training on the Buddhist path but not completing it is still merit surpassing that of humans and gods. And then Chinul says, but he who does not lose the right cause for the attainment of Buddhahood, and who, moreover, listens and believes, trains and completes his training, and guards his achievement without forgetting it, how can his merit be calculated? He continues, if we consider our actions in our past wanderings in samsara, we have no way of knowing for how many thousands of kalpas we have fallen into the darkness or entered the interminable hell and endured all kinds of suffering. Nor can we know how many times we have aspired to the path to Buddhahood, but because we did not meet with wise teachers, remained submerged in the sea of birth and death for long kalpas, dark and unenlightened, performing all sorts of harmful actions. Though we may reflect on this once in a while, we cannot really imagine the duration of our misery. How can we relax and suffer again the same calamities as before? Furthermore, what allowed us to be born this time as human beings who are clear about the right road of practice? Truly, a human birth is as difficult to ensure as a blind turtle putting its head through a hole in a piece of wood floating on the ocean. That's from an allusion to a certain sutra. That's how rare it is to encounter the Dharma, is as rare as a sea turtle that comes up to the surface of the ocean just once a year and happens by chance to find its head going through a hole in a piece of wood, or a mustard seed falling onto the point of a needle. How can we possibly express how fortunate we are? It's easy enough to look at these warnings of Chinu and see them as archaic or just based on old religious texts of written by the superstitious. And many people will do that, even people listening to this talk. But hold on, what if he's right? What if he's right about rebirth, and that we have for numberless lifetimes been circling from dark path to dark path, wandering in darkness? And now we have encountered the way, we are practicing the way, we have a chance to realize the way. Continues, whenever we become discouraged or lazy, we should always look to the future. In one instant, we might happen to lose our lives and fall back into the evil realms where we would have to undergo unspeakable suffering and pain. At that time, although we might want to hear one phrase of the Dharma and would be willing to receive and keep it with faithful devotion to ease our misfortune, how would we ever encounter it there? On the point of death, remorse is of no use whatsoever. I hope that all of you who are cultivating the path will not be heedless and will not indulge in greed and lust. Do not forget to reflect upon this as if you were trying to save your head from burning. Death is fast closing in. The body is like the morning dew. Life is like the twilight in the west. Although we are alive today, there is no assurance about tomorrow. Bear this in mind. You must bear this in mind. You hear in this the pleading of a man who has seen into the nature of life and death and is desperate to save us from more suffering. And then I found, about 100 pages deeper into the book, I found a passage where he talks about working on mu. So let me read that. Master Da Wei, whose approach we follow nowadays is the 17th generation original share master of our school in Cao Qi's direct transmission. Remember, Dao Wei is renowned master, Chinese master, who revived the koan school, the koan method. It had fallen into a real bad condition. The shortcut approach, that's referring to the koan, the shortcut approach he established, which gains access to realization through close investigation of the koan, is quite different. Why is this? Koans like the cypress tree in front of the courtyard, 3 pounds of flax, a dog has no Buddha nature, and so forth, which were expounded by masters of the school, are dharmas completely devoid of any element of ultimacy. But after having given a koan, which is tasteless and impossible to get hold of, Da Wei warns. So he's just saying that these different koans, any koan, just looking at it from the outside, seems to have nothing to it. But we bring to it, through our concentration, a great deal. He says, as long as the... No, this is... He's quoting Da Wei. As long as the affective consciousnesses have not been destroyed, the fire in the heart will continue to rage. Keep your attention on the koan at all times and deepen your questioning toward it. For example, a monk asked Zhao Zhou, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Zhao Zhou replied, Mu. You should only be concerned about keeping this question before you and your attention always focused. From the left, you cannot get to it. From the right, you cannot get to it. You should not understand it to mean yes or no. You should not take it to be the no of true non-existence. You should not consider it in relation to doctrine. You should not ponder over it logically. You should not think the master is explaining the koan when he raises his eyebrows or twinkles his eyes. You should not devise stratagems for resolving the koan through the use of speech. You should not busy yourself inside the tent of unconcern. That's a great one. You should not busy yourself inside the tent of unconcern. Now, that's a phrase that run across elsewhere in Buddhist and Zen texts, the tent of unconcern. People who have been there know what this is. You should not look for evidence in the wording. You should not grasp at a deluded state simply waiting for awakening. There is absolutely no need to use the mind in any way. Once the mind is without any abiding place, do not fear falling into emptiness. It is certain to be a good place there. This one is especially important. There is absolutely no need to use the mind in any way. The discriminating mind. The mind that sees forms, concepts. And then he ends, Da Wei ends, when a rat suddenly enters the ox horn, wrong views and inverted thinking are both cut off. This is a refers to the ultimate focus, focusing on the koan, mu or whatever one's koan is, to the point where you are oblivious of anything around you, but completely single-mindedly focused on, in this case, mu. Qinuo then picks up there. Once the student has heard this sort of explanation and has been given his koan, he should then merely raise it to his attention and investigate it during the 12 periods of the day and in all four postures, sitting, standing, lying down, and walking. 12 periods, the monastery schedule is divided into 2-hour periods. He should have no understanding that the mind nature is either separate from words or free of signs, nor should he have any understanding of unimpeded conditioned arising. If there is even one thought left of knowledge or conceptual understanding regarding the Buddha Dharma, he is enmeshed in the 10 defects of understanding. Therefore, he should lay them down, while avoiding deliberations about whether to lay them down or not, or whether he is enmeshed in a defect or not. Unexpectedly, in an instant, the student activates one moment of realization in regard to the tasteless, elusive koan, and the Dharma Dhatu of the one mind becomes utterly evident and clear. The hundreds of thousands of samadhis and the immeasurable meanings contained in the mind nature will be fully realized without even seeking for them. And this happens because there is no preliminary bias toward what is gained via theoretical understanding and acquired knowledge. This is the secret formula for realization and entering through close investigation of the koan, the approach taught in the shortcut approach of the Zen school. So Chino is right here with us. If you want to see him, see Mu. Reach a samadhi. Breath samadhi, a koan samadhi. Mind undivided. Everyone here is within striking distance of this state of no mind. Truly. Don't let up. Stop now and recite the four vows.